Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
California's new way of not doing business. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. The governor's in Asia, the legislature's in recess, and there's still no state budget. But billions of dollars in bills keep rolling in. Most Californians can weather the fiscal storm unless they study or teach at community colleges, do business with the state, or need state-funded clinics for health care. And while elected officials ignore their jobs, property values are going down along with state revenue. Public schools and local governments are in for big trouble. Also tonight, sailing off Southern California with the largest animals on Earth. Later on, is income inequality a threat to the middle class? First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The income gap between the rich and the poor makes the U.S. comparable to some banana republics. What are the causes? What does the income inequality mean for the middle class? We'll get some conflicting answers later on. We'll also hear what it's like to sail with 100 blue whales between San Pedro and Catalina. First, property values are going down all over California. In Silicon Valley, where high-tech billionaires live, they have dropped for the first time since the Great Depression. Tax assessors are lowering rates, and that means the state and the counties will be getting less money. David K. Johnson was a Pulitzer Prize winner at the New York Times. He's now a columnist at Tax Notes and professor at Syracuse Law School. David, always good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, Warren.
Tell us a bit more about the declining property values and what that means for state revenue.
Well, there's some real long-term significance in this. Prop 13 has a moderating effect. As property values rise in the real market, property tax revenues don't rise nearly as fast because your value is fixed at the time you buy your property, and there's this minor inflation adjustment that can take place. Well, on the downside, the same thing is taking place. So the drops have not been dramatic, but some counties have had quite significant drops. 13 of the 15 largest counties in California had declines. One of those two that is supposed to have gone up, I'm very dubious that it did, Kern County. I think reassessment will prove in time that's not the case. And on the downside, what happens is that as property values have fallen, in some places 60%, people will lock in those values. If they fall further, they'll get reassessed again at a lower price, and roughly a third of those people will probably still own their houses 20 and 30 years from now. So there's a real long-term implication because the state's been spending money like this was not going to happen.
And Prop 13, of course, means that as long as you own your house, it can only be reassessed upward by 1% if, in fact, the property value justifies it.
Yes, it can be adjusted only by a bonded indemnity voted by the citizens or by this particular unique California inflation rate, which rose by a third of 1% for the most recent year.
Now, there's also a drop in new construction.
Yes, that's the second part of this. That the reason my column in State Tax Notes was called Ominous Trends is that not only do you have falling property values, but you have this collapse of construction. And Larry Stone, the Santa Clara County assessor, told me about how he was driving one day in the northern part of the county, what we think of as Silicon Valley, and he went past seven brand-new office buildings, landscaped, striped for parking, and they were empty. Wow. And he predicts that there will be law firms that as their leases expire and engineering firms will be withdrawing or shrinking the number of floors they have. And so commercial property values, he believes, will fall continually for several more years. And I think that he's probably right about that, even with an economic recovery.
So what does this mean for the states and the counties?
Well, one of the effects of Prop 13, and disclosure, I was young and voted for it in 1978, is that it concentrated power in Sacramento. It took away from the responsibility from every school board and city council and board of supervisors to deal with their budget and deal with the voters on property tax rates and put all the power in Sacramento. And this is going to simply put more pressure on the state to meet the basic fiscal resources and needs of the state. Now, California has what's called a first call provision in its constitution for education. Educating young people has the first call. That's a very strongly worded constitution on this issue. And the state is, I believe, going to face continuing challenges. There already is, I'm sure you know, Warren, some experts who think that the degradation of education in California has damaged the economy of the state already, and certainly to the extent that the state shortens school times, delays textbook purchases, forces better and higher-paid teachers out, and increases class size, that is a decision to basically be poorer in the future. It's a distant future, a couple decades out, but it clearly is if you don't continue to treat this first call provision as serious, it will mean a poorer future for California.
David K. Johnston, again, once with the New York Times, now at Tax Notes and the University of Syracuse Law School. Speaking of how things are going in Sacramento, Shane Goldmacher is a reporter there for the Los Angeles Times. Shane, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
So all this power in Sacramento, including the power to pass a state budget with all that it now has to include for the counties and for education as well because of Prop 13, we have no budget, and we have a governor who's touring Asia. What's the legislature doing?
They've adjourned for the year besides having to come back and vote on a budget eventually. We're already the second longest time in state history since having a budget. It was due on July 1st, the beginning of the fiscal year. We're now more than 75 days into the fiscal year, more than 20% of the way through the year without a budget.
Okay. What are the prospects? Are they doing any negotiating? Are they taking this seriously? Are they waiting for the November elections?
They've been doing some negotiating, but less now that the governor left for Asia. He left last week, and he comes back tomorrow. A lot of negotiating, not a lot of public progress. You know, there's a very large hole, about $20 billion, $19 billion, and the decisions they need to make are essentially what taxes they'd like to raise, if any, and what cuts they want to make, if any, along with a mixture of accounting tricks and other things to get the books balanced. And the task gets harder the longer they take.
I want to come back to the issue of the election in November because there's an important measure on the ballot that relates to the budget. But first, Shane Goldmacher, this doesn't seem to be hurting as many people as it did the last time that the budget went on as for a long, long time. Why not?
You know, one of the reasons last year the state issued IOUs in July, just days after the July 1st beginning of the fiscal year. And this year they sort of planned for not passing the budget on time and deferred certain bills. But there are, by the end of this month, nearly $6 billion in bills won't have been paid. Health clinics that serve the poor are no longer getting money. College students who rely on Cal grants for low-income students are not getting their money from the state. Any business that contracts with the state, if you deliver fruits and vegetables to a prison or you're providing IT services, all those businesses haven't been paid. And so the state is essentially forcing hundreds of thousands of people to borrow money while they don't pay them.
How soon are they going to have to hand out IOUs if the state runs out of money?
Originally, it was supposed to be earlier this month or by the middle of September. Some positive cash flow in August meant that it was pushed back till at least early October, which as soon as that announcement was made last week, it was like releasing all the pressure on the negotiations up here. As soon as that was announced, everyone just sort of took a sigh of relief and decided not to keep working nearly as hard, at least publicly, for a budget.
Shane Goldmacher, reporter in Sacramento for the Los Angeles Times. Jim Mangia is chair of the board of the Community Clinic Association of Southern California. He's also executive director of the St. John's Well Child and Family Center. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what's happening to you as a result of this delay.
Well, the situation is bordering on catastrophic. What we have is the state is not paying health care providers for the provision of health care services to poor and publicly insured residents. Many clinics are cutting back on their services and many patients are being forced to crowd even more our emergency rooms, which is crowding out people desperately in need of emergency services. So the situation has reached a crisis.
Elaborate a little bit more when you say catastrophic, and I understand what you're saying. If services are cut back, if ERs are crowded, how does this affect people who aren't directly affected by the failure to pass the budget?
Well, what this does is, you know, for example, diabetic patients who need diabetic medicine will not be able to get their medication. Patients who need to see a doctor will not be able to see a doctor. Clinics are being forced to cut back on the provision of services because of the running out of reserves, the use of lines of credit, borrowing from different banks, and so on. So you have a kind of a situation that piles on itself, where the clinics have to borrow money in order to keep going. They have to pay interest on that money. By the time the state pays them, they've lost money on the services that were provided, and you have a lot of patients who are literally lining up outside the doors of community clinics throughout the state who cannot get served. So what's going to happen to people in poor communities who cannot get their diabetic medication, and what's going to happen to people in middle-class communities that need an emergency room that's crowded with patients who are just going there for primary care as a result of this budget crisis?
What about public health?
Well, obviously, this is going to have a tremendous impact on public health. We're talking about immunization programs not being paid for. We're talking about flu shots not being available. There's just a whole host of things that are that, you know, as the winter season and the flu season comes up, we're in a really serious situation here. And it's shocking to me, you know, that the governor would decide to take a trip to Asia. It reminds me of the Pakistani president that decided to take a trip to England during the floods in Pakistan. It's a very similar, you know, out of touch response to a crisis situation that he participated in creating.
So, Shane Goldmacher, here we have Jim Manja saying that this is catastrophic and giving us some evidence to demonstrate that. You said there was great relief in Sacramento when they found they wouldn't run out of money completely until early October. What about Proposition 25 on the November ballot? That would change the Constitution so that instead of a two-thirds requirement for the legislature to pass a budget, it would be 51%.
Yeah, that initiative would dramatically change how budgets are written in Sacramento. And the one public poll on it that I've seen was in July by the Field Poll, and it had it ahead by a great deal, 65% to 20%. Similar measures have been on the ballot before, and voters tend to be pretty skeptical of them. Voters send mixed messages and a mixed mandate to their elected officials. On the one hand, they'd like them to come to an agreement and sooner, both in Washington and in Sacramento. And on the other hand, they like rules making it harder for them to come to those agreements. In Washington, they support, you know, the filibuster rule, and here typically they've supported higher requirements to get taxes and budgets in place.
But there are rumors going around, as I understand it, that there might be advantages to either party to allow the budget to go so long that it might have an impact on Prop 25, or even from the Republican standpoint, that if their candidate wins for governor, they might get some additional clout that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the longer that the budget drags on, the longer that this dysfunction becomes public and some of the impacts on clinics and other places become a bigger part of the public discussion, the less it's going to be able to be ignored both by voters and by the candidates running for governor. Voters are going to sort of be given a choice. Given the dysfunction that you see, do you want to change the rules of how things happen? And the Democrats would hope that they would say, yes, we should lower the requirement. And the Republicans are going to point to the dysfunction and say, why on earth would you let fewer people make this decision? It already doesn't work as it is.
So obviously there's a lot at stake for both parties, but nobody knows quite how to assess this. David K. Johnston, back to you, one of those who voted for Proposition 13 in 1978 when it passed. Is this something, do you think, that has had sufficient unintended consequences that it really ought to be looked at again?
Well, I think it would have been good if Proposition 9 in 1978 had gotten more votes. That was the one that limited Prop 13 to homeowners. It may have included apartments, but I think it was just homeowners. Most of the benefits of Prop 13, we're finding, are going to commercial and industrial properties. And one of the questions that I think needs some thorough examination is how well the assessors are doing in catching sales of property. It turns out that, for example, when Long's Drugs, which you can find everywhere in California, was bought by another chain, they retained a single entity called Long's Drugs LLC, which has the same address as the purchasing company, CVS, and none of their properties were reassessed, even though they were sold to a new company. And you do have to wonder how widespread that problem is.
Shane Goldmacher, the legislators aren't paying any attention to the impacts of not having the budget. What about that aspect of Prop 13? Are they alert to that?
Yeah, there has been some legislation this year trying to change how commercial properties are assessed. It's one of those things, though, that is very divisive, and you know, some Democrats have raised the prospect. Republicans have been pretty much united against that idea, and the business community says, you know, if you want to reassess business properties now, it's a bad time during a down economy, and it would cost jobs.
Okay, Jim Manja, you said that the governor, you were very critical of the governor for leaving town. Apparently he's coming back tomorrow. How much longer can you keep going the way you are?
Well, I think you're going to start seeing, as you did last year, you're going to start seeing clinics close, and you're going to start seeing clinics close permanently. So you're going to see a dramatic decrease in services as well. You're going to see clinics cutting back on hours, cutting back on staff, cutting back on doctor time, in order to try to keep afloat as long as possible. I mean, this is, as the reporter from Sacramento said from the LA Times, this is the second longest delay in getting a budget in state history. So community clinics, which are nonprofit organizations, don't have a lot of money in the bank. And so we're really operating on a shoestring to serve the poorest, most vulnerable residents like children in California.
Jim Manja, chair of the board of the Community Clinic Association of L.A. County, executive director, St. John's Well Child and Family Center. Shane Goldmacher in Sacramento for the L.A. Times. David K. Johnston, in addition to his other credits, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Thank you all very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. Blue whales are the largest animals ever to live on Earth, and 40 years ago they were almost extinct. Now about 2,000 live in the North Pacific Ocean, so it's very rare to see 25 all at once, much less 100. But that's what happened to KCRW's Matt Holtzman, who was sailing yesterday afternoon off Marina del Rey. Good to have you in our studio.
Very glad to be here. And I have to say that the guy that I owned the boat with had actually been out a couple of days before and seen a few, and I just thought it was a total fluke, no pun intended. But last night, it clearly was no fluke because we saw a lot of them.
What do you see? What do you hear?
Well, you actually hear them first. The thing was, there's four grown men on a boat having a nice evening sail. We hear the sound of water, you know, spouting out of a whale. We turn to see it, and the four of us are yelling like, you know, teenagers at a Beatles concert. And we spun the boat around to see if we could follow it, and there were a few whales out there. The first thing, all we could see was just the water shooting high up into the air. And then eventually you could see the backs of the whales as they kind of came up out of the water. And it is such an awe-inspiring sight.
How close were you?
You know, I think we eventually got to as close as maybe 30 or 40 yards. And at one point, one of the whales spy hopped, so the head came clear out of the water. And, you know, I have a fairly large boat. It's 35 feet long. And you realize how tiny it is compared to these things. They are absolutely massive and at the same time emit this extraordinary sense of peace. There's nothing kind of frightful. At one point, we looked at each other and we thought, is this safe? You know, should we be heading out of here?
Moby Dick.
Yeah, but there was a sense that they are just there kind of observing that they're aware of you. They're looking at you. They're swimming around you. And then they kind of swim off. We must have seen, I have to guess, between 4 and 6 different whales. And at the end of the evening when we thought they were all gone and the sun had almost completely gone down, we were sailing into shore and we could see their spouts, you know, against the sunset as they sailed, as they swam away. And it was just a magnificent sight.
So you didn't see 100, more like 6.
I did not see 100. Well, it's hard to know. It could be one swimming back and forth. I think it was probably like 4 or 5, which is remarkable because I've been sailing in these waters my entire life. I think I may have seen a whale once before, and I'm not even sure about that.
Matt Holtzman, director of KCRW's program development, as well as a experienced sailor off Marina del Rey. Michelle Souza is Aquarium of the Pacific's senior marine mammal biologist. Ms. Souza, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This is pretty rare stuff, and I gather that boats now are going off of Long Beach and elsewhere with people on them, and they get to go out and see these whales. How long is this going to happen? Go on.
Well, you know, right now we're having a great whale-watching season because we are seeing such high numbers, more so than we've ever seen in years past. And one way that we may be seeing this is because they're feeding. and it's just like a big party. All of a sudden you have great feeding grounds, and you're going to have these whales come and join other whales in feeding, and that's probably what's happening. We're going out every day now, and we're seeing on average anywhere from 6 to 15 whales on a whale watch trip.
Well, now, the whales live on krill, which is, as I understand it, tiny little stuff. How do they know it's there, and are they able to signal to one another when they find it?
Well, krill is very tiny. It's one of the smallest creatures in the ocean, and you have one of the largest creatures feeding on it. But blue whales are unique in the fact that their calls can be transmitted quite long distances. And so if there's good feeding grounds, a whale can put off a call and tell other whales that there is time feeding and literally call everybody to dinner.
So as long as the krill are there, the whales are going to be there.
Exactly.
So this could go on for a long time, I take it. Matt Holtzman, you weren't able to hear the calls of the whales, were you?
No, we could not hear that. The only thing that we really heard were the spouts.
Michelle Souza, is there a way to hear the calls from the whales?
Well, actually, we're one of the few whale watch trips, pretty much the only one, that actually has an acoustical array on our boat that we can deploy. And if the whales are talking, you can hear them. We have both low-frequency and high-frequency capability on that boat, and you can actually go out on the Harbor Breeze cruises that are affiliated with the Aquarium of the Pacific, and if the whales are talking, we can hear them.
Our Matt Holtzman said that his boat got within 30 yards, he thought, of, once again, the largest animals ever to live on Earth. Michelle Souza, is that a good idea?
You know, it's always good to give them their distance. There are laws out there saying that you have to kind of respect their area, but we've had whales that were respecting their area, and they actually come up to the boat because they are inquisitive, especially we just had an instance where a baby blue whale actually came up to the boat and was swimming around the boat while mother kind of hung off to the distance and watched. So it's these guys are very intelligent, and if they're curious, they'll come over and say hello.
Matt Holtzman is nodding his head here.
Yeah, and we did not chase them down. They chased us down,
exactly,
for sure.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's one of those things, if you have a right-sized boat and they're in the mood, they may come over and say hello.
We might have looked like a big whale.
35 feet long. How long are the whales, Michelle Souza?
You know, for an average size, it's 75 to 80 feet long.
And twice as long as the boat?
Yeah, and blue whales can weigh over 1,000 or 100 tons, which is about 100,000 kilograms.
That's just sort of mind-boggling, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt, do you want to go back out knowing now what you heard?
I tell you, you really don't feel any threat from them. They do seem like they're smarter and more peaceful than we are and just a little bit curious. But I have actually heard stories of boats being broken in half when they run into whales. I don't expect that would happen here, but I suppose it could happen.
So, Michelle Souza, I guess they don't have any predators.
You know, only when they're young can they have some predators. You'll have killer whales attacking blue whales, as well as great whites have been known. There have been bodies found with those type of wounds on them.
And people, of course.
Yeah, and people, of course.
People who almost have made them extinct.
Yeah, we're pretty much the biggest problem for these animals.
So is there still whaling of these animals? I know there are a lot of problems with the international rules on whaling.
Some areas are allowed to take them, but for right now, we actually have a very good population off our coast. We have about 2,000 to 3,000 that we like to consider it actually a nice destination for them. They're not passing through. They're always kind of off our coast, so we're very lucky.
So, Matt Holtzman, going to take a little time off?
Oh, I would love to go out and visit him again, for sure. Okay. And I would recommend everyone do the same.
All right. To Matt Holtzman again, KCRW's Director of Program Development, Michelle Souza, at the Aquarium of the Pacific, Senior Marine Mammal Biologist. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page, and in a moment, is income inequality a threat to the middle class on Which Way LA? Herman Olney back with Which Way LA. In 1915, the top 1% of Americans had 18% of the nation's wealth. Now they have 24%. That's despite the invention of labor unions and government regulations and the income tax. Timothy Noah is a senior writer for the online magazine Slate.com. He's written a 10-part series on income inequality, its effect on the economy, and what can be done to reverse the trend. Good to have you, Timothy Noah, on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Tell us about Paul Krugman's idea of the Great Divergence.
The last 30 years, we have seen a steady increase in income inequality in this country. And a lot of people sort of accept that, well, that's just life. You know, under capitalism, incomes grow ever more unequal. But in fact, for the half century or most of the half century that preceded this most recent trend, starting in about 1929 and into the 70s, we saw incomes growing more equal, particularly starting around 1941. So this feature of life in the United States in the mid-century, the growing income equality has disappeared. And, you know, there are still a number of people who can remember those years. Those were very prosperous years. The economy boomed in the post-war years. It wasn't really until the 70s and especially the late 70s where we started to see incomes diverge, and they've been diverging ever since.
What were you able to determine was the cause?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint an individual cause. The way I structured my series was I identified eight possible causes and looked at them. Some of the causes that seemed most logical did not seem to have any actual effect. For example, race and gender. We're well aware of the fact that there's a great deal of income inequality between races and between genders, but the income inequality between blacks and whites has not gotten worse over the last 30 years, which is nothing to brag about. It hasn't gotten better either. The gender-based income inequality has gotten better, somewhat better over the last 30 years. So those can't be the reasons. In the end, I concluded that education played a very big role, that in general government policy played a big role. The decline of labor unions played a big role. Trade played some role. Immigration played a fairly minimal role. A phenomenon I had a hard time describing in a single word, just Wall Street insanity, I guess is what I would call it, also contributed a great deal.
Timothy Noah, once again, senior writer for Slate.com. Diana Furchgoth-Roth is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's also served as chief economist of the U.S. Department of Labor during the presidency of George W. Bush. Good to have you on our program.
It's great to be with you. Thanks so much for arranging this.
Are you surprised to hear the conclusions that Timothy Noah has arrived at?
I am a little surprised because you frequently hear the view that rich people are earning more and that income inequality has increased. But there are a number of demographic reasons behind that. One is the preponderance of two-earner couples. So whereas 25 years ago, maybe a doctor would have married someone next door and they would have had a one-income family, she would have raised the kids. Now the doctor is marrying another doctor that he meets in medical school. They have two incomes. And one of the things that we could do, in fact, to reduce the distribution of income to make it more equal is just to say women have to stay home and they can't work.
You're not advocating that.
I am not advocating that, no. Definitely not. So I think that what we really need to be concerned about is not increasing inequality, but the fact that with the new penalties on employers for hiring, the increase in the minimum wage, lower-skilled workers are having an increasingly hard time getting their foot on the first rung of the career ladder. We're seeing teen unemployment rate around 26%. Unemployment for adults without a high school diploma over 14%, and with the increase in the minimum wage to $7.25 an hour. If you add in Social Security, workers' comp, unemployment insurance, that brings the cost to the employer of $8 an hour. We're basically saying that workers in the United States who have skills less than $8 an hour are forbidden to work, and that's going to have consequences not just now, but in terms of these workers being able to get on the career ladder, get a job, and move up. Similarly, the penalty of $2,000 per worker per year that the new health care bill is going to impose starting in 2013 for firms that don't have the right kind of health insurance, that's going to prevent low-skilled workers from getting hired. And we're already hearing that fast food restaurants, which is one of the main employers of this group, are cutting back on operations within their restaurants. They are bringing in more prepackaged food. There's a substitute of capital for people. And the question is, where is this group going to get jobs from? How are they going to get entry-level slots in the workforce? And how are they going to be able to move up?
If, in fact, you're suggesting that the biggest problem here is with those lowest on the income ladder, and we have now this tremendous concentration with a very few at the top, is the answer to this redistribution of income?
Well, redistribution of income, in other words, higher taxes, has consequences of its own by reducing economic incentives. And what's interesting is that we're finding that many other countries are trying to lower taxes, trying to provide more incentives. The higher taxes are, the less incentive businesses are going to have to locate here and expand and take risks. And the economic literature is very clear on that. Where we had some of the biggest booms in economic activity, in labor force participation rate, in job growth, has been after tax cuts, looking at the Kennedy tax cuts in the 1960s. That was followed by a boom. The Reagan tax cuts of the 1980s. And we had a substantially long expansion when taxes were cut in 2003 under the administration of President George W. Bush.
Diana Furchgott-Roth, again, Senior Fellow Hudson Institute, Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, formerly with the Department of Labor during the George W. Bush administration. Timothy Noah, let me go back to you, Senior Writer for Slate.com. You wrote 10 parts of a long series on this. What about the middle class?
Well, the middle class, the demographic explanation for the inequality boom, I think, really doesn't get you very far. It makes some difference, but Stephen Rose, who wrote a book last year called Rebound, looked at this, and he said that when you correct for demographics, median household income was higher than the census's official figure. But he said that the inequality, it did not erase the inequality boom. And a lot of the inequality boom is driven by incomes at the very, very top, people making over $1 million a year. And that, of course, has nothing to do with yuppies marrying each other, unless they're extraordinarily successful yuppies. So I don't think the demographic explanation really, really does get you very far. And the tax cut explanation is also, I think, misleading because, yes, Reagan lowered tax rates, the marginal tax rates, considerably. But that's exactly when the inequality boom started to take off in the 1980s in a big way. So clearly, the rhetoric of the time was a rising tide lifts all boats, and the rising tide did not lift all boats.
What about that, Ms. Furchgott-Roth?
Well,
Roth,
I'm not sure equality is something that we want to aim for. If we were in favor of equality, we could all move to Haiti or we could move to Cuba where everyone is equally poor. What we want to do is ensure that we have mobility throughout the income distribution. And we naturally expect the income distribution to get more and more unequal because we have more opportunities at the top, yet we need to preserve entry-level slots at the bottom. So we always want to have low-wage jobs so that teenagers and people on drugs, people without education, can get their foot on the first rung of that career ladder. We want to keep those low-wage jobs so people can get the jobs and use it to move upwards. And we don't want to place any limit on incomes at the top. Therefore, in a growing economy with opportunities, we will naturally see an increased inequality of income. There's nothing wrong with that. What we really need to focus on is income mobility, and that's where I am concerned that we are stepping back.
Let me turn to Paul Pearson. He's professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley, author most recently of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Professor, good to have you on our show.
Great to be here.
What do you mean in your title by saying that Washington made the rich richer and turned its back on the middle class?
Well, first of all, I just want to note that the book is co-authored by Jacob Hacker at Yale University.
Thank you.
And we've worked through all of this together. And I have to say our basic argument picks up on a lot of the themes that Tim Noah has explored in his really excellent series, in particular that there hasn't just been a growth in inequality, but that it has been highly concentrated at the very top. It's not as if the rungs on the ladder have just spread out a little bit. It's as if the top two or three rungs, you know, the top 1%, the top 10th of 1%, the top 100th of 1%, they've just shot off into space and moved away from everybody else. So the change that's taken place, it's not that either in Tim's series or in my book with Jacob that we're saying the United States should look like Haiti, but in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and first part of the 70s, it was an economy where everybody's incomes were growing and not even becoming more equal, but at least growing at equal rates. And the middle class was really benefiting from economic growth. But for the last few decades, that has not been the case, and especially in the most recent period. So if you look at the economic recovery that took place under the Bush administration, and I believe the previous speaker was in the Bush administration.
Department of Labor.
Two-thirds of the income growth that took place between 2001 and 2007 went to the top 1% of the population. And that's a huge transformation in the American economy and American society. It's not that we're saying that you should move back to Haiti, but the United States has been moving in a direction, as Tim points out in his series, of looking more like Latin American economies where it's winner take all, where the people at the top are garnering almost all of the income growth. And in the book, we argue that that's not just a natural economic phenomenon. It's not something that's just a result of technology or globalization. It's something that Washington has played a very important role in encouraging through a variety of policies. And one way that one clue that it's not a natural phenomenon is that if you look at a whole range of affluent democracies, while there has been an increase in inequality in many of these countries, there's been nothing like the sharp shift towards the top 1% or top 10th of 1% that you see in the United States.
Ms. Virchow-Roth, back to you. Can you argue that if two-thirds of the income growth goes to the top 1%, that's a healthy situation?
Well, the top 1% in 2007 before the recession paid 40% of total federal income taxes, which is more than the bottom 95% of taxpayers. The bottom 95% of taxpayers are paying an increasingly smaller share of taxes. The top 1% of taxpayers are paying an increasingly larger share of taxes. So we have people who are very well off, but they are paying far more taxes than people at the bottom. In fact, the bottom 50% of income earners, according to the latest data, the bottom half of income earners paid less than 5% of total federal income taxes. I see nothing wrong with people having more money and paying a larger share of the tax burden, therefore funding benefits.
Paul Pearson, let me go back to you. I'll give you an opportunity to respond to that. Again, you're the author of Winner Take All, co-author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Warren. And the first thing I want to just mention is that the previous speaker, I don't think really answered your question, which was whether or not a situation where two-thirds of the income growth is going to the top 1% is a good thing. I think the answer to that, I think most Americans would say clearly that's not a healthy thing to have so little going to so most of Americans while so much goes to so few. And again, this is a big change from the way that the American economy worked through most of the 20th century. It is true that the and this is something that conservatives love to point out, that the share of income taxes that the top 1% have paid pay has gone up in the last few years. But the reason for that is pretty straightforward. Their incomes have gone up so dramatically compared with anybody else, everybody else's, that naturally they're going to end up paying a higher share of taxes when that happens. If you look at the tax rates that they're paying, however, those have actually dropped dramatically over the past few decades. This is one place where I disagree a little bit with the way that Tim Noah writes about it in his Slate series. If you look inside the top 1%, at the very very wealthiest Americans, the top 10% or top 100th of 1%, the tax rates that those folks are paying have dropped very dramatically over the last 20 or 30 years. And now you have really remarkable situations like the treatment of significant amount of income by hedge fund managers, where they're paying 15, you know, they're making incomes of hundreds of millions of dollars, and even though it's not their own money that they're investing, they're getting taxed at the capital gains rate, which means that they're only paying 15%, while middle-class Americans are paying much higher rates of tax. So the fact that the amount of taxes has gone up mildly on the wealthiest, their incomes have skyrocketed, I don't take much solace from that.
So you're saying then that even though the top 1% pay 40% of the taxes, they're not paying their fair share?
Well, I think that American society worked a little. I think we've long had a progressive tax system, and some belief that that the tax system ought to work to draw from the people who can most afford to help finance government. You know, that's a system that's been in place for a century. And I think, especially in a context, I mean, to me, it's quite astonishing that in a context where this is the segment of society that has really the only segment of society that's been doing well economically over the last 20 or 30 years, and they've been doing not just well, but fabulously well, that there should be a fixation on cutting their tax rates.
Let me go back to Diana Furtscott-Roth and clarify, if you will, in response to what Professor Pearson said, whether this is a healthy situation.
Well, I think now we don't have a healthy situation because our economy is slowing down. But two or three
years ago.
Well, what
about this distribution of wealth, though, that two-thirds of the income growth to the top 1%?
Well, again, I think the important thing is economic mobility. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And one reason, as he pointed out, that this is a big change from most of the 20th century is because starting from 1986, with the Tax Reform Act of 1986, there are a lot more partnerships. Small businesses had the incentive to file under the individual tax code. So some of that two-thirds is businesses. And they are filing. They used to file as corporations, but then when the top tax rate went down to 28% in 1986, they started filing as individuals. And so it's not really correct to compare the pre-1986 with the post-1986 data. Besides, when you look at the different income quintiles, this isn't looking at the top 1%, but the top fifth. Most people don't know that 30% of households in the lowest income group, the bottom fifth, and 32% in the second quintile own their homes free of mortgage, whereas 17%, much smaller, in the top quintile own their homes free of mortgage. The quintiles are different. There are fewer people in the bottom fifth. There are more people in the top fifth. There are households with more earners on average in the top fifth. And the bottom fifth, there are, say, census data show there are half an earner per household as opposed to 2.1 earners per household in the top fifth. So I think that this fixation with what percent owns what and what percent earns what, without looking at the composition of the households throughout the income spectrum, is misplaced. And again, we should look at the taxes that these individuals pay. We should also look at what a desirable society the United States is, with millions of people wanting to come here. If we wanted a more equal society, we would expect to see Americans flocking to Sweden
or Americans flocking to France to try to live there. We don't see that. We see the Swedish, the French, the Germans applying to come here rather than the reverse.
Let me go back to Timothy Noah, the senior writer for Slate.com, who's done the 10-part series on income inequality. Did you hear, as we are hearing on this program, differences of opinion about mobility and equality?
Well, the mobility question is interesting. This was actually one thing that I was completely unaware of when I began my research, was that income mobility has declined in the United States relative to other countries. There was a survey done.
How do we define mobility in this context?
It's comparative, and I'm not quite sure what I can't recall precisely what the measure was, but there have been surveys, comparative surveys done by the OECD, and what they found was interesting. They found that the United States, which you know we think of as the land of Ragged Dick, land of upward mobility, the United States now lags several countries in what we're used to thinking of as the class-bound old world. France, Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Spain, these are all places where there is more social mobility than there is in the United States. Canada and Australia also. I wasn't aware of this, and people in general, I think, are not yet aware of this. There was a survey done between 1998 and 2001, and, you know, as you would expect, the country where the highest proportion of people agreed with the statement, quote, people are rewarded for intelligence and skill, was the United States, 69%. But that perception hasn't caught up with reality, which is that mobility has declined somewhat, as you would expect it to, as when income inequality expands. You reach a point where mobility becomes more difficult. There's more territory to cover.
Now, Paul Pearson, you have a lot of ideas about what Washington could do about income inequality, but won't the divisive politics that we have today make that very difficult?
Well, I think it absolutely does. I mean, partly because there's very substantial polarization between the parties, and you combine that with the development of the filibuster in the Senate. We think of this as almost as something that's built into the Constitution, but I think people don't realize the extent to which that's become a newly prominent feature of American politics. Filibusters used to be really unusual until the 1990s, but now you can't pass anything unless you can get 60 votes in the Senate, and you know that combined with the polarization, it really makes it difficult to carry out serious reforms. And then the other thing that Jacob and I really stress in our book is that there are powerful organized interests that are quite content with an economy that is directing so much of its largesse towards people at the top. And those groups are very active in Washington. The Chamber of Commerce is going to pour a huge amount of money into the upcoming election, unprecedented amount of money coming from a single private group. And that also makes it very difficult to get the kinds of changes you would need in Washington to turn some of this around.
And you think that Washington is the place to go for the changes that you want to see made?
Well, we do. We don't claim that politics and government is the whole story here. I mean, there have been very important changes in technology, and we live in a global economy, and we're not pretending that politics is the whole story here, but we think it's an extremely important part. And again, it's, I think, a really vital thing that people realize, that what's happened in the United States, the moving towards a sort of, you could call it a sort of Willy Wonka economy. One of the previous speakers was talking about income mobility and social mobility being the key, but when so few people are getting that golden ticket, that really does create a lot of negative effects in society, especially for the middle class. They're not getting those golden tickets. 99% of them are not going to get those golden tickets. And it's important for people to realize that other very developed economies, very successful economies, have not been experiencing the same kind of concentration of income that the United States is experiencing.
Okay. Timothy Noah, back to you. Final question, senior writer for Slate.com. As you put together your 10-part series, do you see these kinds of issues being played out in political campaigns around the country as we approach the November elections?
Certainly, President Obama talks a lot about the shrinking middle class and the challenges to the middle class. But I'm just struck by the fact that even though there is some talk about challenges to the middle class, there hasn't been a lot of talk about what's been happening for the last 30 years and the need to really come up with a solution.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. Timothy Noah, again, a senior writer for Slate.com, 10-part series on income inequality. Diana Furchtgott-Roth, formerly with the Bush administration, now at the Hudson Institute, the Manhattan Institute. Paul Pearson at UC Berkeley, winner-take-all politics, how Washington made the rich richer, turned its back on the middle class. Bill Bishop, editor of the Daily Yonder, his book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart.